The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Vesta Movement. Their instructors set the tone for high energy, ass kicking, and constantly changing workouts that challenge all muscle groups by incorporating both cardio and strength training. People of all levels of fitness will fall in love with their new approach to kickboxing classes. They've got the hottest playlists, the most encouraging trainers, and an awesome tight-knit community. They're here to change the fitness game in the ATL. I went down for my first class the other day and loved it. Alex and Missy and their team, they'll kick your ass. They'll take great care of you. It's badass trap music. It's an awesome, awesome way to get in shape. You can check out the website for more at VestaATL.com. They're located at 774 Ponce, which is next to the local, across from Dugan's, and catty corner to, you know what, the Claremont Lounge. Go down there, check them out in person, or hit them up on the web. That's VestaATL.com. Good day, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Atlanta Podcast. I am your host, Mappy Davis. It's a rainy Saturday in February here in Atlanta, Georgia, bringing you the second episode of the week. As promised, every week, every Tuesday, you get a brand new one, and then I give you another one some point later in the week. Today, it's Saturday. On today's episode, Tiffany Andrus Myers. I hope I'm saying it right, because as long as I've known Tiffany, which is now a couple of years, I realize I've never actually addressed her by her last name. So, Tiffany, let me know if I'm pronouncing it right. As you know, I like to let the interview do the talking. So, I will not do a long explanation about what we talked about. You can read that on your phone. And if not, because you're running or driving, just get into it and just enjoy. I will say that it was a deep conversation, the kinds of conversations I like to have, the exact reason I started this podcast. Sure, what does this person do for a living and what have they done in their life? But much more, let's get into what makes people tick and how that affects the macro in the world and how that affects each other. I think that's a pretty good description of kind of how it went. Great chat. It was a while ago. This comes from the I was going bananas July, August, September doing interviews. And as we're cleaning out that vault on the second day of the week podcast, Tuesday will usually be the newer ones. I think that's kind of how it's going. Really, it depends. Anywho, here is it. Here it is. Here is it. Tiffany and I. It was a gorgeous day. Away we go.
Test, test, 1, 2, 3, 7, 14.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Long time no see.
I know.
Did you have dreads last time I saw you?
Oh, goodness. I don't know. Definitely not when we were working together.
Because you were a dirty hippie back then, and
I totally
now now you are the dirtiest of hippies.
I know. It's perfect, isn't it?
Right. You do have to talk a little bit closer to the...
Okay.
So why don't we start there? Can you tell people how we met?
We met, way back in the day... What was that, 2 years ago?
2015?
Yeah. So I was working for Postmates as their community manager for Atlanta, and you came in and just astounded me with your suave and clear customer service skills.
I think
so
you're
I
lying.
Had to hire
I think you're lying now.
yeah. So you were my Postmate for a while.
Why did you end up there?
So I have an interesting twisty turny life story. I got my master's degree from Georgia Tech, and kind of realized at the end of getting my master's degree that I had checked all of those boxes you hear about as a kid, like, hey, go to school, do really well in high school, go to college, get a degree, get another degree, get a job, and then you'll be happy. And at the end of all those check boxes, I didn't find happy. So I kind of made a life switch, went and spent a month at a monastery, came back and was like, what am I going to do with myself? So I jumped from jobs, from tutoring.
Was it not speaking monastery?
It was a little bit of both. I spent about a week not speaking and about 3 weeks I could speak. And the not speaking was by choice. But actually on Saturday I leave for another week of not speaking. So.
Well, then I'm glad I caught you when I did.
Yeah, it was good timing.
I should really do that. I've heard about like 10-day no speaking, like meditation retreats. And I'm like, man, is that what I need?
Yeah, I'm a firm believer it's what we all need. My wife actually just got back from one that was just a weekend. And she came back a little disappointed. And it's totally understandable.
Now, when you say wife, so you're a girl.
I am.
And she's a girl.
I know.
So...
we like each other.
You like each other.
Yes.
Not dudes.
No. We both tried that and it didn't work.
Right.
Luckily, she got a son out of the trying it for
so
a while.
Now you have...
So now I have an 8-year-old.
And a little family.
Yeah.
I also have an 8-year-old.
Isn't that amazing? I think we've talked about getting them together.
As a matter of fact, my other wacky world, didn't we talk about doing the obstacle thing?
We did.
That's what it was. That's
yeah,
what it was.
We talked about getting my son in the Ninja Warrior camp.
Right.
Because he's still all about parkour.
Yeah. So 2 years ago, when I last did that stuff, we were going to do like a summer thing in that class that ended up not happening or whatever. But now I'm remembering.
Yes.
And it turned out like we were almost neighbors maybe too. Because that was the other thing is that anybody that I wanted to do it with did not live anywhere near me. They're like, yeah, I'll do it. But I live in Norcross or whatever.
Oh, no. I'm in Grant Park.
Right. But I was in Kirkwood, I think, at the time.
Yeah, that's right.
So we were almost neighbors.
Yeah.
So your wife was disappointed that it was only a 2-day. She wished it was more.
Yes. She came home and was like, what is this real life thing?
Right.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a, what do you call it?
Culture shock.
Yeah. I got to say, not to be one of those people, but I was just in Europe and, and driving. So I landed in Barcelona and we went to Andorra.
Oh, that's so nice.
And on the way to Andorra, you're like, what am I seeing? And what you notice is what you're not seeing. And you're like, okay, I don't see billboards everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
There is no Starbucks.
Nope.
Now I love my Starbucks, but there isn't one, right?
Yeah.
It's just rolling hills for all you can, for miles and miles and miles.
And people driving appropriately.
And then, what's his name? The guy that was with me goes, why are the roads here so good? I go, because government works over here?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's insane, isn't it?
Right.
It really, really is.
Just seem to have that. I'm sure there's issues. They seem to have that basic needs thing down.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely issues. There's always going to be issues. But I spent 3 months in Europe, and it's remarkable how different it is. You know, even in the places where they speak English, and you're talking like big cities like London, where it's kind of the same cultural identity of, you know, working one way and playing one way. Just the way they experience the city and work with each other in the city. Like, you go up an escalator there and everybody stands to the left. And if you're walking, you move to the right. Like,
right.
That consideration doesn't happen here.
Right. People stand up on the bus when there is an older woman approaching.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Yeah.
Again, but now we sound like those people and we don't want to be those people.
I know.
But I do want to say that it was... that I did, there were things I missed about home. So, by the way, I've traveled a few places and quote unquote everybody speaks English, right? Like,
yeah,
in
yeah.
many ways. So I went to the Middle East, I went to Lebanon. Everybody spoke English, right?
That's crazy.
Yes, big time. Like, very Western over there. I mean, they've got that great Lebanese, amazing. Oh, great to meet you. They've got that style, but
yeah.
It's all American. But anyway, but and I thought Europe would be that way. Not certainly not in Andorra. And where they speak Spanish and what's it, Catalan, whatever it's called?
Yeah, Catalan.
Not much English.
Yeah.
Like, some people little, some people a lot. But then when I was getting on the plane, there was some weird thing with security, and there was two dudes behind me that were from Atlanta, and they started talking to each other, and it was like, like it was like nice, like, oh. And then when I stepped on the plane, I literally felt when like the Delta women said welcome, I was like, oh, I'm back. Like, I'm back in America, even though I'm just on the plane. So that was kind of cool. So anyway, I'm digressing. Let's stay with you and your crazy hippie journey through life.
So I don't think I ever answered your Postmates question. How did I get to Postmates? So once I got back from the monastery, I tutored. I rode my bike as a courier for Jimmy John's. I worked for Instacart. And really, it was my experience with Instacart as a shopper and a driver that when I heard Postmates was coming to Atlanta, I was like, okay, I want to be the guy that treats all the me's at Instacart with the respect they really deserve.
Right.
So 17 interviews later, I got the job with Postmates. And that's how I met you.
Right. And then how did that end?
In a kind way, I will just say that my ability to be the human being that I wanted to be, in a managerial role and that whole desire to treat people with the respect that they really deserved, you guys worked hard, you know, it wasn't what I thought it was going to be. I didn't have that ability to take care of my team the way I thought I was going to be able to.
Well, I'm not sure if I told you this before, but I'm pretty sure we talked a little bit about, but so I did Lyft and Uber in the early days of both, where the money was really good for relatively easy work. And we were this great little community of 50 to 100 people.
Yeah.
And then it became what it became, which was lower and lower rates, a lot of promises never delivering, and that happy, joyy, pink mustache feel wasn't there. It's funny, we used to joke because we sort of accepted it from Uber because they didn't pretend to be fuzzy.
Yeah.
You knew they were the fucking New York Yankees. You knew they were like, fuck you, work for us or don't, we don't give a shit.
Right.
And Lyft was like the happy fuzz. So when I met you and everybody felt the way they felt, I'm like, I've seen this movie before.
Yeah.
Like, first of all, she won't be here very much longer.
Yeah.
Right? I'm going to enjoy it while I can. This is great extra money or decent extra money. But I know how this is going. And sure enough, you know, like you weren't there that much longer. And it was like, I couldn't do it anymore. Like for me, I needed to go. Like my business was doing well, but I realized that I can't sort of be a little pregnant. I was like, I just got to go all in and not do any of this day job stuff anymore. And I was able to, you know, make the other podcast go how it went.
Yeah.
But you almost like you personified that's exactly who the Lyft community managers were, always somebody like you, young, cool. I want to take care of you guys. Let's make this happen together.
Yeah.
And then the reality hits of like, oh, these guys are a fucking corporation like anybody else and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. I mean, you pretty much described it exactly as the experience went, you know, and exactly what you described about the warm fuzzies with Lyft is how I felt with Instacart. I was one of the first like 20 people hired at Instacart in Atlanta.
Right.
And it really was that close-knit community. You knew the community managers. We all talked, you know, and slowly but surely those promises weren't fulfilled. You know, the way we were getting paid changed, and now all of a sudden you're not making the same amount. There's no incentive to actually care about your job anymore. And that was definitely the experience as a community manager as well, you know, and it was just like the exact same experience, but a level up. You got the same, I don't really care what you think, and you're not going to get paid for the work that you do.
But P.S., by the way, we have this extra event going on, and go do that.
Right. No, do everything.
Right.
Do it all. I mean, everything.
Because you love the company, and trust me, one day we'll take care of you. Wink, wink.
Right. And the cool thing with Postmates is all the me's around the country, all the community managers around the country. I mean, exactly like you said, even with Lyft, right? They're all like super cool, chill, really passionate people. I have never in my life, still to this day, worked with a team of people that was more passionate and really damn good at what they do. All of these people running the cities for Postmates, they knew what they were doing. They were powerful individuals. They were driven. We were making no money, and none of them cared because they cared about what they were doing.
Right.
And it was an inspiring team to be on. I still really firmly maintain that I don't understand the way business runs in our country today, simply because I'm a firm believer that if you treat the people who work with you well, there's an incentive for them to treat your customers well. It's not even like an incentive. It's like you begin to believe in what you do. And when people are passionate about what they do, you don't have to convince them to convince other people. It comes natural. And then you get customers for life and you get employees for life. And it takes something big to lose either one of those. And I really just don't know how we've lost that perspective. It seems crazy to me.
Yeah, and there's certain, you know, I can hear, like, you know, my stepdad's voice or whoever that's like, well, you know, that's nice, but, right?
Right.
And I don't expect it to be the perfect rainbow world, but there are plenty of companies that do exist and are successful who take care of their people, take care of their customers, and... You know, I think the business example is like Richard Branson, right? And then the great opposite is like Steve Jobs, who's like this motherfucker, but people got it people got it done because they believed what he was saying so strongly. But some people think that's the way to do it, right?
Yeah.
Just be this maniacal
cult leader.
That's a good way to put it. But I think people follow Branson the same way. Some people do.
Yeah.
But anyhow, so right. And I think so for all of us that have that entrepreneurial spirit, that's always the deal, right? It's like, okay, I like bringing this to the world and that's nice, but now I've got to go this next level up,
right,
of hiring and firing and managing money. And, you know, that's a whole nother like ball of wax. So how is that going for you? Well, first of all, tell people what you're doing now.
So I have transitioned full time into teaching yoga, meditation, and mindfulness, which is infinitely more awesome than trying to manage, offshoot of a major corporation. So I kind of have two businesses simultaneously. One is the personal one, that's more yoga focused. And that's teaching private clients and a few businesses here and there where I do classes. And then I also have a nonprofit, which is focused on bringing the tools of mindfulness and meditation to, I say, people who deserve them and often don't have access. So the underserved communities around the city. And as far as that next level managing, that's definitely its own hurdle and experience of learning. You know, I've always been good with managing money and I enjoy working with other people, but doing it from a business aspect has certainly been a learning experience. It's definitely new.
Yeah. My experience with both of those things, you know, I've had just sort of massive swings like both ways with money. So I think people that manage money better don't have those swings.
Probably. I will 100% admit as well, when I was going through my yoga certification, my teacher, I'll call her my guru, made it very clear that teaching yoga is a labor of love. So I don't have very much money to manage, which makes it a little bit easier.
Right.
And starting a nonprofit, my goal is to bring these things to communities that need them, which often means communities that can't pay for them. So I've developed a business model where I'm bringing the tools of mindfulness to businesses around the city of Atlanta who pay for my services, right? And then those businesses paying for a program donates a similar program to a community, a shelter, a nonprofit organization, a community center, and they get to do it for free. But, you know, at the beginning stages of something like this, it obviously takes capital in order to be giving things away for free. And what I found is it's actually easier to give the things away for free than it is to find the capital. So right now I'm teaching a lot of free programs, which is what I wanted to do. You know, I really want to get these tools into the hands of people that need them. And the business is slowly growing in its own way. And I've truly found that when it comes to just about anything in life, if you allow it to evolve organically and stop attaching to how fast you think it should be moving, it goes a lot better.
Well, how am I supposed to do that?
Well, that's exactly the beauty of mindfulness. At least for me, you know, I get these ideas in my head of the way things should go or the way they should look. And I think should is a really important word.
Oof.
Yeah.
It's a killer.
It is. It is. Because if you hold on to the shoulds, you really miss the beauty of what is. So I'll say, starting this nonprofit, none of my shoulds have happened. None of them. I mean, maybe a few, you know, like I hold a monthly meditation that's free in the parks. And people come to them. So that's should, right? That's an expectation that's actually happening. People are coming, which is great. But it's not like all of a sudden people loved the idea of a nonprofit for mindfulness and started giving me loads of money. And it's not like all of a sudden businesses were like, yes, we need this and we have all the money in the world to pay for it.
How are you at asking for money?
I think I'm better at pitching the idea than asking for money.
You're okay. People walk by and like whisper and tiptoe and it's all good.
Well, yeah. As soon as you're holding a microphone, there's something
scary.
Well,
I appreciate their respectfulness, but first of all, we can't hear them. And second of all, I just like, I'm fine when people say hello. Anyhow, yeah. I apologize.
No apologies. But yeah, I think I'm better at pitching the idea than asking for money, but it's hard to ask business people. So like we were talking about, like that type A personality of, you know, I'm running a business. It's hard to ask those people to give away their money, especially for something that it's not already set aside for. Like, sure, if I'm selling insurance, I can call your business and say, I know you have a chunk of money set aside for this. But to call up a business and be like, hey, I want to teach meditation classes at your office, where's the money for that?
What if I told you, that's a total, like you made all that just up.
What do you mean?
Like, I mean, I feel like we can have this dialogue that whatever, like you have created that trap for yourself.
Well, that's based on my experience.
Well, if you called some people for insurance, they would say, nope, don't want it, don't need it.
That's true. That's very true.
Right?
And I do agree with you, the mental trap. What that I talk about that a lot. It's a story.
Correct.
Right? Right. So I made up that story.
That
and it's based on pieces of experience, but the linear timeline of a story that has a destination and a final outcome isn't based in reality.
So I may have told the story before on the show, but I don't care. I will tell it again. Well, because it's like I talk to people all the time and sometimes the same stories come up and you don't want to bore people with the same thing. But
I haven't heard it, so.
Gosh darn it, there you go. So I had a staffing company in 2010, which was the height of like the world is falling apart and the housing market sucks.
Okay.
And many, many, many people in and out of my industry said, you know, nobody has any money for marketing. You know, marketing is the first to go, right?
Yeah.
Nobody's going to put on these big, huge conventions or do marketing events. I had my best years. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Were there certain businesses that went out of business or lost? Absolutely. But I refuse to go with that.
Yeah.
Can't fucking, this town sucks. Nobody's cool here. Right? Right?
Atlanta?
I'm saying anywhere in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
Like you'll find that.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
So what's the common denominator, right? So, and I'm telling you the big aha moment I had, this is the part I think I've said before in the show is I went to Target one day there at the, what's it called?
Atlantic Station?
No, right here.
Oh, Caroline Street.
Caroline Street.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was just a regular day, a Wednesday, right? Kroger, Target. And I looked around the parking lot and I was like, there's nothing wrong. If this parking lot was empty, it'd be like, oh shit.
Yeah.
Everybody is out spending fucking money.
Of course they are.
Okay. So anyhow, so that's so I, cause the reason I'm telling you this, it's cause like a spot it got it thing. You know, I've been in business a long time and I get very hung up in not valuing myself enough, being afraid to ask for the money. They offer less. I say, okay, please, I'll take it because I'm not worth it, right? So that's why I'm like excited to like not correct you, but like to offer this to you. Like
it's empowerment. I appreciate
so
it.
So you got to let go of this. Like they don't have the money for it. You got to let go of that and say like, I've got this awesome, valuable thing. Do you want it? Great. Cool. You don't? Okay. Let me go to somebody else that does.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm right there with you. And the truth is the reason I say I think I'm better at selling or talking about the idea than asking for the money is because I really, when I talk to businesses, I don't talk about the money. I talk about the product or, you know, what it is that the value that they're getting. And the money is secondary because truthfully, it doesn't matter how much I ask for. What I'm offering is worth it. Right. And I think that's what
you're
saying.
You can't miss with that attitude.
No. Well, and I believe in it, you know, which is exactly what we were talking about earlier. If you have people that believe in your business or believe in what they're doing, you don't have to convince them to sell something. And I started this because of the way that mindfulness changed my own life, changed my own experience of life, my view of myself and my world. And the fact is, when it comes to business, if you give people a chance to actually connect with what they're doing, they're going to be better at what they do. And so we live in this world, and the businesses that I connect with are, I've worked with a couple advertising companies. My wife
the most evil people in the world.
Yeah. Well, you've got to be careful. My wife is in motion graphics.
I sell advertising for this pod, not for this podcast, but for my other, like, I'm saying it kiddingly.
Yeah. Well, you're saying it immersed, right? it's the truth is, most advertising people have to live in a computer, on their phone. I read a statistic the other day that said we self-interrupt or are interrupted every 3 minutes. And we check Facebook like 74 times a day and email like 35 times a day. I'm kind of fudging those numbers, so
I would put that on par.
Yeah, I mean, I'm close, but I'm whether it's 74 or 73, you know.
Sure.
But I only say that to say that there really isn't a higher value than you can place on the people who work for you being happy and being good at what they do, liking what they do, and being productive, right? And so in places like advertising, we are asking these people to be probably more productive than any other human beings on the planet. But they don't take breaks. Like, you don't breathe. Most of them don't eat lunch. And so, sure, you can stay immersed in your work, but how highly functioning are you really without food, without being able to give something your full attention, and without even knowing what's going on in your environment?
So I'm going to be Joe, person on the street that you're talking to.
Okay, Joe.
And say, I really appreciate what you just said. Nice hippie lady. But my boss is too demanding. I have to work through lunch. I have to eat at my desk. I don't have any extra time to meditate. Boy, that sounds nice for you, hippie lady, but couldn't work for me because I don't have the time.
So I don't have the time is one of the biggest hurdles I come across. And the truth is, I can tell you from experience that I have lived that. I've lived that excuse. And I'm going to call it an excuse because what that is our ego and our attachment to a way of being. And asking somebody to sit down and meditate is a huge change from what you're used to, right? But there was an amazing study done by Aetna. So Aetna, the health insurance provider, they brought mindfulness into their workplace. Okay. And so they put a handful of employees through mindfulness training, and a handful was kind of their control test group, right? And what they found was that taking time out of their day actually increased employee productivity. So essentially, they saved somewhere around 300 hours per employee per year in productivity, which came out to be about $3,000 per employee in productivity cost that they saved from actually giving their employees breaks. So what I'll tell you for me is that I want to train the CEOs. I want to train,
because if they get it, they'll make it happen.
Exactly. Once people get it, once they have the experience themselves, I don't need to coerce or trick someone into buying into this stuff. You know, like, this is not a product that I'm selling. It's a way of being in the world and being with your life that is translatable into all experiences.
Yeah. And I think that we do live in a time where it's actually pretty, like, certainly way more accepted than it was. Like,
oh yeah.
You know, if you listen to, you know, podcasts where they talk to leaders, they ask them, do you have a morning routine? Do you meditate? And a lot of them do, because, you know, they you know, these are, you know, titans of industry, as they say, and
right.
they miserable, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
All the money in the world, and they're miserable. And so then they're like, huh, what's next? And then someone goes, maybe you should check out this, you know, shutting everything off and meditating thing.
Yeah. And exactly what you just said is exactly what I said earlier about my own experience. I was a very successful human being, like in terms of what you expect from a citizen in our American culture. I was very successful up until the point of being 25, and I wasn't happy. You know, I did great in school and had a master's degree from Georgia Tech. And here I was looking for jobs. And it was very clear to me that I was just walking into the exact same thing I had already experienced. And what was going to make it any different? You know, and so we exist in this space where we feel like possessing things is what's going to provide us happiness, this idea of success. And I still really struggle with that because I spent 25 years ingraining in my brain that success equals happiness, that I have to work a certain number of hours or I'm not okay as a human being, you know, and I really battle with that still. But the truth is, we're not going to find happiness outside of ourselves. You know, we're going to find happiness outside of ourselves in the sense that, at least from my experience and the experience of people I know who do practice meditation and mindfulness as a way of life, it's things like you and I sitting down and talking right now, making genuine human connections and still being aware of the absolutely gorgeous day around us that's going to create happiness. And so I think you're right. You know, these big tycoons of business go through and at some point midlife crisis is, I think midlife crisis is a result of we've done everything we're supposed to do and happiness isn't here. What's wrong? Right. And as soon as we start asking that question, what's wrong? We can start looking for other alternatives. And I think it's beautiful. I think midlife crisis is beautiful. I had midlife crisis at 25, you know, which is great. But I think it's when we ask that question, what's missing, that we can start figuring out that it's not our normal way of being.
What about not just the money part, but my need to be liked and loved by everybody?
That's a hard one. I certainly feel that way from time to time, you know, especially when you're a business owner, right? You want everybody to like what you're doing and you want everybody to buy into it. But I truly believe we have to like ourselves before we can think that anybody else is going to like us. One of my favorite things to come out of my own meditation practice is, you know, in the Buddhist tradition, they talk about there being no self, right? Which at first is sort of a concept of like, what does that even mean? I think the most beautiful way I've ever heard this described is if you take a car, okay, so take a car, put it in your driveway and take it apart. Break it down into all of its constituent pieces, right? So here you have this car laying in pieces on your driveway. Now point to the thing that is the car.
Right.
You can't.
Right.
Right. The engine's not the car. You can't get in the engine and drive around in it.
Right.
And so the same thing is true of us. There's nothing about this thing that is me that I could point to and say, this is me. Like my personality is drastically different at 30 than it was at 25, than it was at 15, right? My memories, we have so many people in old age that have dementia, but if my grandmother gets dementia, does that make her not my grandmother anymore? No, right? And if we get thrown onto a desert island, all of these things that I define myself by, I'm a mom. If my son wasn't there, am I still a mom, right? I'm a business owner, not anymore, but I'm still me. So I say that to say in investigating what that really means, not having a self, I had this realization one day that how I define and see myself is never going to be the same as somebody else defines and sees me. And the way you define and see me is very different than the way my wife sees me, which is different than the way my son sees me, which is different than even two people I meet at the exact same time who hear everything I say the same, they're still going to see me differently.
Right. So here comes a spiritual quagmire.
Okay.
So a great maxim is what you think of me is none of my business, right? Which people say when someone says, that guy doesn't like you. Well, hey, what do you think? So on the other side of that coin, if somebody sends me a Facebook message and says, I really love who you are and what you stand for and who you do, I'm supposed to not assign that much value to that, but I absolutely do. And I might read that message 10 times.
Right. So my degree is in biology. ecology and evolutionary biology. And so for me, when it comes to spiritual questions or when it comes to mindfulness and meditation, I find a lot of power in science. And so what I would tell you is, if you look at the evolutionary history of human beings over space and time on the history of our planet, we had to live in groups, right? When we're roaming the plains with no stagnant place of living, if you got kicked out of your group, you're screwed, right? There's no way you're going to survive on your own without a tribe. And so it is literally built into our brains to want to be a part of a group or a cohort. But the thing that is interesting is that just by existing as a human being on this planet, we are a part of a group. We are a part of a cohort. We are fine just the way we are, and we are accepted in some way by everything around us. So I can't blame you for reading that message 10 times, because your reward centers in your brain and your group think centers in your brain are firing and giving you like crack as soon as you read that, you know? So why punish ourselves for something that feels good and is encouraging to spirit? I don't find a reason to punish ourselves or ignore that the things that encourage us, but to define ourselves by them is right. That extra step that we should probably look at before we take it. At least is my thought.
I'm just like sort of like, you know, taking that in.
Thank you. I definitely think that's something we all experience. You know, I certainly do. Anytime I get encouraging words, it doesn't matter who it's from. It certainly automatically ignites my brain and makes me happy.
So if that's the case, I'll speak personally, because I wanted to say we, but speaking personally, why, you know, there's the classic thing, I used to do stand up, and there's the classic thing that you want to get that one person in the room that's whose arms are crossed.
Oh yeah. Like,
why am I focused on that guy? There's a room full of people, right? Or the one negative thing at Facebook that goes, that guy's a fucking hack. And then, like, that can ruin my day. Like, why? What's in my brain? You just talked about the science. What's the science behind that? Why I'm going to now flog myself for an hour?
Well,
or abuse drugs, sex, food. I totally want to talk about the food thing, by the way, because I'm having a big issue with that. But
okay.
Anyway, right?
So our brains also have a negativity bias, and I'm really less certain of why evolutionarily that's important. But we certainly seek to confirm whatever it is we believe. And for some reason, our minds want to believe the most negative thing. So there's been some research that's been done on the psychology aspect that looks at people's memory. And the absolute first thing that people's minds will go to when recalling an experience is the negative aspect of the experience. Doesn't matter if it was like the most beautiful experience in the world, we're going to think about the one thing that was negative, and then maybe we'll start thinking about the positive things. And I can't really tell you why that is. I'm not sure that there is an answer scientifically. And if there is, I'm not really sure why. But I would imagine that it's protective, you know, like something I talk about a lot when it comes to mindfulness is, I want to say this because I think it's important. People think meditation is hard, right? And they think that meditation means turning off your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard a guru talk one time, and he said one of the funniest things. He said, it's taken millions of years to get this brain. Why do you want to turn it off? It makes no sense. We've evolved this beautiful brain that helps us interact with the world in the way that we do. And for some reason, we're supposed to turn it off. No, we're not turning it off. What we're doing is we're becoming aware of it and taking away the fact that it's controlling us all of the time. And so I only bring that up to say that negativity bias is probably also kind of associated with our fight or flight, right? Our stress response. And again, going back to evolutionary history, it was really important to have a fight or flight system. Because if you're a dude walking through the plains and there's a rustle in the bushes next to you, it could be a lion going to eat you, or it could be nothing, right? And so there's two mistakes our brain could make. It could be a lion, and we mistake it for not being a lion, and then we die, right? Or it could be nothing, and we mistake it for a lion, and we're still alive. We just are a little stressed for a minute. And so our stress response has been on overload. You know, now we get cut off in traffic, and it's a lion in the bushes.
Right.
Or we get an email from our boss that says, hey, come see me, and we catastrophize it.
How about just the email that you're waiting to get, the yes or no email that you're waiting to get?
Oh, my gosh. That can be so stressful. The questioning of whether it's going to happen, right? And we go over it, and we go over it, and we go over it. And those are one of the most beautiful places that I think mindfulness can come into play, because the practice of meditation is as soon as your brain pops a thought into your head, right? Because we are not our thoughts. Meditation teachers all over the planet will say, watch your thoughts, right? And I love the little gentle wave of the hand that comes with that. Just watch your thoughts as they come and go. And it's so gentle and it's so sweet. But it took years and years of meditating before I really even understood what that meant, because I was never watching my thoughts. I would be 45 train cars down the train of thought before I even realized I was thinking, right?
Right.
And so the practice...
And it's a really fast moving train.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're 45 train cars down in what, 10 seconds?
For me, I think it's more like 45 bulldozers into my...
I only call it a train because it's a train of thought, but I like the bulldozer. It's true. We bulldoze ourselves.
Right. The first one that I heard that I liked was... like clouds or like tissues. Like, it sounds weird with tissues, but I think that's really how just this floating thing. It's like, okay, here goes that one.
Yeah.
Like, here comes another one.
I think of it as bubbles a lot. Like, these thoughts, the more you sit, the more you'll really begin to see that your brain just produces thoughts. Like, and if you ignore or let go, like I've heard a guy say every time he has a thought, he's like, oh, there's my brain thinking again.
Right.
You know, and what really matters when we meditate is how we address ourselves when we catch those thoughts, because we're going to think. That's what our mind does. It's designed to think. It's designed to relate us to our world. And what I find is that when I sit down, the first thing that bubbles up is either something about a relationship or work. Right. And if I can let that go... And if I can be like, that's not important right now, and I let that go, all of a sudden it'll pop up like some TV show I was watching, right? It's like, how am I relating to this TV show? And if I let that go, then it's going to pop up something else. And it's just the nature of the mind. It's going to think. But back to your question, you know, when it comes to ruminating on something, that is inherently taking us out of being alive. As soon as we are so attached to... I need to check my email. I need to check my email. I need to check my email. We're forgetting that we have feet. We're forgetting that we're breathing. We're forgetting that there is a room around us. And so if we can practice every time our mind goes, I need to check my email, we take a breath and say, no, I just need to relax, right? And it's going to happen again. I need to check my email. No, I just need to relax.
So do you have... much experience either personally or with people you know with addiction?
I've had experience with family members with addiction.
Right.
Yeah. And I've had my own experiences through life with addiction.
Right.
I don't think I have an addictive personality, which that's a funny statement to make.
Right.
I think addiction is very much a product of our brain and our experience. The things I've dealt with addiction with, I've been able to move through with an ease that I feel appreciative of. But I know from my experience with family members that it's not easy.
Yeah. So I'm sober from drugs and alcohol for 18 years.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And in those 18 years, I've experimented with everything else.
Yeah.
Gambling, food, sex, like everything, right?
Yeah.
But the food one never really was there. It was just kind of like, you know, I have a high metabolism, I exercise, whatever. So today, age 45, I cannot eat like I used to eat and keep. And it is become a thing for me. I think I was like most guys and like, whatever I'm wearing, I look good. You know what I mean? Sort of stereotypical guy thing.
Yeah.
And I feel every bit of the extra 7 pounds that I have now and, or eight, whatever it is, and completely focused on it. And it's fucking me up.
Yeah.
It's so messing with my, like, I'm so not okay with it. And, you know, it's like my wife and everybody else in the world is like, come on, dude, you're not fat. Like, and it's like, doesn't matter.
So what about the experience are you not okay with, though?
It's all I see in pictures.
So it's about the visual perception,
correct,
not like the physical experience of your body.
Well, it's not nice when something doesn't fit anymore either.
Right.
That's a thing.
But it's not like you, it's not that you feel like you don't have energy or you feel sick or anything.
Well,
like
when
that.
I run these, you know, I do these obstacle races, and when I do these races and I'm carrying a few, I can definitely feel it. But,
okay.
But for the most part, it's definitely an ego thing, of how I look thing, and a why, like the question, like not to ask, which is like, why can't I stop?
Yeah.
Right. Which is again, like, you know, like, it's like the crack addict, like just go to the crack addict and kick him and go, stop smoking crack. It's bad for you. You
know? Right, it's not going to happen.
but I've just never had it. And I think that's why I'm struggling so much with it. Cause I've never had it with the food thing. I could eat whatever I wanted. I exercised, didn't matter.
Yeah.
And now I'm totally.
Well, it's interesting. I have a yoga client. I came from a client's house here this afternoon, and we had the exact same conversation. Now this woman has 4 children. So she has birthed four lives into the world. And she's about your age as well. And for her, it's really the same experience. She feels it in her physical body, too. You know, she said the other weekend she ate ice cream for like 3 days in a row. And we actually talked about how in her experience, it is an addiction mindset, in the sense that for her, once she eats one bowl of ice cream, her mind is like, well, screw it. I've already screwed it up. So I'm just going to eat whatever I want because I'm going to feel like crap anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Totally relate.
Yeah. What I can say for your experience is I'm sure a lot of women appreciate how you feel. You know, your experience of how your body changes with what you eat definitely is going to differ as we age, right? The way we process food is going to change as we age. But as you know, because you're looking at me, I'm a pretty small person. And
ish.
Yeah, smallish. And there are aspects of my body that I still feel uncomfortable with. And there is a really beautiful meditation practice that I did on my last silent retreat. And the mantra is not me, not mine, not myself. And it's in relation to our body. Understanding that the same way we broke down that car and we couldn't point to the thing that was me, that this body does not define me. Right?
Hang on though, because you're throwing caution to the wind, I don't know what the right phrase is, in this whole thing that, like, in this whole self-help thing of like, oh, you can't say not because that's, your mind doesn't hear it. Like, so you don't say, I don't want to be fat. You say, I want to look good, or I want to be healthy.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't want to be broke. You say, I want to be rich. I want to feel wealthy. So, like, how does that work?
So it is the total opposite of that.
So we've been told the wrong thing?
No.
I've been following the wrong gurus?
No, absolutely not. Because the difference is that we have the association to our body. We already define ourselves by our bodies. And so this practice is designed to break that. It is designed to break that attachment to defining ourselves by what we look like. By defining ourselves by this body. Because the truth is, let's say you lose 7 pounds and get ripped, right? When you're 80, is your body going to look like that?
I don't know. You see those things sometimes of people, right? Look at this woman. She's 75 and she's like,
yeah. Well, that goes back to the food thing. I'm going to maintain that all those people are vegan.
we won't even go there.
But truly, it doesn't matter what you do. Your body is going to age and we are going to die.
This is what I tell people about getting married, by the way.
Okay.
It's advice I was given. I think I was given this advice. If not, I made it up. Great, I'm a genius. But you say to someone, like if someone says, hypothetically, like, this person is amazing and her body is this and blah, 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 blah. I'm like, just give you a heads up. Have you looked at your grandparents lately?
Right.
That's what she is going to look like.
Yeah.
So just giving you a heads up.
Yeah.
Because that's where it's at.
Well, and it's true. It's the exact same thing, right? We can't marry someone because of what they look like or we're screwed.
But many of us do.
Many of us do. I think my wife is beautiful. But I don't just think she's beautiful because of her physical form, which I think is where we become successful.
Wouldn't that have been amazing, by the way?
That would have been amazing.
I just tried to catch a fly a la Karate Kid or any movie.
Fly might have been easier. You went for a gnat, my friend.
Right. And if I had caught that gnat, seriously, I would end the podcast now.
And just take a lap.
That's spiritual enlightenment right there.
Exactly.
Right. Are you a Bruce Lee fan?
I do love some Bruce Lee.
Yeah?
I used to be a martial artist when I was a kid.
Really?
Yeah. Black belt in Taekwondo, my friend.
Really?
Yeah.
What is the difference between Taekwondo and Karate?
Taekwondo is more feet-based, and Karate is more hand-based in terms of the action of the martial art.
Along with... I should meditate more and I should learn to speak Spanish. That's another one that's on the list of like shit I'm probably not ever going to do, but is on
martial
that.
Arts.
Yes.
Dude, I want to learn,
all of them.
Yeah, I do. I really do.
Because I am aware enough to know that it's not about the striking. It's about the knowing one's body and knowing oneself and all that stuff.
The big one on my list is Tai Chi for that reason. Like, just, you know, it has chi in the name. It's obviously about your energy and that movement of energy.
Right.
And so...
Do you know who this is? Hang on a second. I know Kung Fu. Do you know who that is?
That's so familiar. Who is that?
That's... what's his name from The Matrix?
Oh, yes! Oh, my God. My son loves that movie.
Really?
Yeah.
Good old Keanu Reeves.
Neo.
Right?
Yeah.
So many great lessons in that movie, though, no?
Yes, absolutely.
My friend Rob downstairs says that when I ask him a question, he says, the answers will come, Neo. I'm like, God, fuck you. Because you never want to hear that, right?
It's true. But I was talking to somebody recently about the fact that you could get the answer and actually probably already have heard the answer to whatever question you have.
Right.
And you were just not in a place to understand what it meant. And one day somebody's going to say the exact same thing that you've heard for like 10 years. And all of a sudden it's going to be like, holy shit, I get it. And it's just going to be because your mind went through whatever experiences it needed to go through. Or who knows? It's because it's raining that day and all of a sudden it makes sense. You know, but I think we can hear the same thing 100 times and it just takes 101 in the right scenario for us to actually get it. You're giving me that look again.
I'm trying to practice like just listening, honestly.
That's an art. That's a real art.
And then something that somebody that said to me once, he's like, silence won't kill us. And I was like, wow. Because that was something that, again, I'd heard a million times, but when he said it, I just heard it, and I was like, try that.
Yeah, I think silence is beautiful.
Right.
Listening is difficult.
Right. Well, that was that. I got that in, like, early 20s and, like, my first. Like, I don't know if we talked about this, but, like, I've done a lot of seminars and whatnot, and when someone said, the first thing you have to admit is that you can't, that you don't listen, and then you can. Oh, fuck you, I can. And then I finally like did. Oh, I'm a horrible listener.
Yeah.
Great. Now we can start somewhere, right?
Yeah. I mean, even as we're talking, I had a teacher tell me once that what I've been doing the whole time we're talking, which is you say something and I'm like, yeah, absolutely. Right. Yeah. I'm not listening when I do that.
Right.
As soon as you start making physical gestures or verbal gestures of confirmation, right, or
right.
negation, who knows,
right.
we accidentally shake our head no. all of a sudden, we're not listening. We're not paying attention.
Well, I am not embarrassed to say that I had a recent bout with anxiety and depression.
Don't we all?
And, well, I used to until I had a fucking real one that took me out.
Yeah.
Like, couldn't. leave the house kind of stuff. So I did a outpatient thing at Ridgeview.
Yeah.
And it was great. Big proponent of Ridgeview, who's not sponsoring this podcast. But one of the things in group, there's signs on the wall, is like, you know, speak from I, blah, blah, blah. But one of them is don't pass the tissues. And I didn't know what that meant. I was like, why would you not want to pass the tissues? But it's like, don't interrupt what's happening.
Yeah.
Like, just somebody's fucking crying, let them cry. And that's a big one. Like, how, like, I mean, it's not bad. Like, I want to hug my kid when they're reaching for it or when they're hurting. But, like, as adults, like, yeah, just why don't you, like, let that person sit for a second, see what happens. Maybe something that, you know what I mean? When you give them the tissue, they're like, now they're thinking about that, or they're saying thank you, or...
Right.
Anyway, it's a big one.
Well, I think we learn that we have to fix our emotions.
Right.
And even with parenting, right? Especially, you don't want to see your kid cry. You don't want to see them hurt. And so I think we get caught up in that trap of needing to fix whatever our kid is going through. And we teach them then that they have to fix it, right? But the truth is... I hear you saying in this group as well that what we really need is people to just be with us. Mm-hmm. We don't need our emotions to go away. Exactly. We just need to know that whatever we're feeling is okay and that we can go through it. And really, you know, I'm miss meditation, but really the cool thing about meditation is what we find is everything comes and goes. And I read something the other day, and it goes back to exactly what we were just saying, that you can hear something 1,000 times, and it's 1,001 in the right words that makes it sink in. And this wonderful author, Stephen Batchelor, he wrote a book called Buddhism Without Beliefs. So it's really this agnostic approach to Buddhism. And he said, the nature of craving is to release itself. And it really just struck me. Like, the nature of absolutely anything that arises, even a deep depression, is to release itself. And we have to wonder how much of our experience is because we hold on to something and we say that it's going to be forever. We create this sense of foreverness and unchangingness. And what we really want to experience when we sit down and meditate and be quiet is that everything changes. You know, even people, I have friends who have autoimmune diseases and these extraordinary body pains. You know, my incredible sister-in-law has had laser surgery on her nerves in her back because they just fire pain all the time. And this woman sits down and started a meditation practice, and within weeks began to experience her pain differently. And it's because she learned not to attach this finiteness to it, you know? And I think once we can let go of that with everything, that we can understand that absolutely every experience is going to change. It's not going to be there forever. That we can begin to experience it differently, really. I myself went through a pretty big bout of anxiety and depression relatively recently. And the really beautiful moments that came out of it were the times when I didn't feel like I had to get over it and I could just be with whatever that experience was. And there was one moment where I was in the shower bawling, you know, in a crumple.
Best place to do that.
Exactly. I think water. There's something about water. But I looked up and there's a window in my shower and I looked out my window and it was epically beautiful outside. And it was this realization that, you know, when we experience these deep sadnesses, we feel isolated, we feel alone, we feel like this is the only thing that exists in the world. And to have that recognition, looking out that window, that there was still beauty in the world and that I could stand up, I could open my heart, open my chest, take a breath and walk outside and maybe something would be different, you know? And it was. And at least for a few minutes, it was beautiful, you know? But yeah, the anxiety and depression are powerful and very, very rampant. Nobody's immune, you know?
Yeah, for me, if somebody said they were depressed, I'd kind of be like, well, you should probably get over it, sad sack.
Yeah.
Right. So for me, going through that, I was given a massive dose of compassion, and I'm someone that needed a massive dose of compassion. Everybody could use a little bit more, but I certainly, like, looking back now, not only because I know what people who suffer with that, but the people that I sat in the room with who suffered from things I'd never even dreamed would be a thing or only saw in the movies, people that hear voices and like to relate to those people. And it were like, you know, and that's what was so good for me out of that was like showing up there. It's all hopeless. I'm miserable. This is horrible. And even my wife, who was a saint through the whole thing, couldn't give me what that gave me, which is why it exists at those places, was, yep, like, totally, man. And we're here, but yeah, what, you know what I mean? Not trying to fix it, not like, they said, well, what do you need? And I said, at the time, I just need somebody to tell me it was going to get better. And they were like, it will.
Yeah, exactly. That knowledge that it's not going to be like this forever.
But it sure feels like it.
Oh, yeah, it does. And truthfully, when you're talking about months of your life, that's forever, at least in those moments, you know? It's powerful. And I find it to be beautiful what you said about compassion, because my wife and I have been in therapy for a few years now. Nothing is wrong. But I love going to therapy with her because we talk about our each of our perspectives when it comes to something. You know, let's say we got into an argument and we'll talk about the argument in therapy, and there will be this like aha moment of all of a sudden I understand what her perspective was, and it generates this well of compassion. Like, oh my goodness. Well, now I understand why you were acting that way. Right. And compassion is a huge part of a mindfulness practice in Buddhist practice. And I think what we strive for with compassion is to remember in every moment that what you learned in that class, right? You learned about these people and what they had been through, and it generated this sense of compassion. And if we can remember in every moment that every human being we've interacted with, they have a story and we don't know what it is. And if we can have the compassion as if we know their story, then we're touching something beautiful. I say that, and it's hard, is you kind of have to be a Buddha to be able to do it, at least in my belief, you know, but I think that's, it's at least what I strive for, is to remember that, you know, when somebody cuts you off in traffic and you have that automatic fight or flight response, if we can remember, we don't know their story, you know? And I heard somebody say one time, like, you don't know if their wife is in the back seat and they're on the way to the hospital. And that's well and great. But when I'm dropping my son off at 7:30 in the morning in Atlanta traffic and somebody's in the left turn lane with their right blinker on, I know that mofo knows that's a left turn lane and they're driving all the way up. But I still don't know their story, you know?
Right. And I can tell you, as a gift of being older, never bothers me, because people use that as such a common thing. Like, somebody cuts me off in traffic, I'm like, in my mind, I can't even think of the last time it happened, because if it does, I don't even give a shit.
Yeah.
Like, I haven't driven over the speed limit in like 15 years.
And
because,
isn't that great?
Well, it's one area in my life I'm okay with, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm checking Facebook 150 times a day, right? So that's, and we can talk about that. But we do need to wrap it up. But I want to give you, I don't want to call it the quiz because that's the wrong name, but it's a way for me to talk about Atlanta. This is the Atlanta podcast.
Yeah.
Many times we don't talk about Atlanta at all, which is fine. Sometimes we go deep, deep into the Atlanta stuff. We didn't hear. This was awesome. There was many times that I was like, oh, we should just end it now because it's so perfect. But it doesn't matter. So I'm going to start with the first question, which I think I know the answer to, but do you eat at the Waffle House?
Oh, man, this is unfair, because the answer would be yes, because I love the Waffle House,
except
I'm vegan.
Right.
And I used to eat there, and I would get hash browns, because I can eat their hash browns, right? And
get them steamed, bro.
I can get them.
You didn't know that trick?
No, my friend, I did not. So in answer
I'm
to
a connoisseur,
your question,
so.
I will be eating at Waffle House soon.
Well, because that's
their steamed.
Well, that's my second question, is what's your plate at the Waffle House? Because everyone has one, like what they usually get.
Well, it's the only thing I can eat there. I get double hash browns with jalapenos, onions, and tomatoes.
And do you know the lingo for those?
Oh, it's been so long. Because it started making me sick because it was cooked on the same grill with everything
else. Of course.
Chopped. Diced. No, I don't know the lingo.
I think tomatoes
anymore.
Is diced.
I think tomatoes is diced.
Jalapenos is something else. Anyhow, what is your favorite place to eat in Atlanta?
Ooh, that's so hard. I would have to say on any given day, I would hit up the Sunflower Cafe on Peachtree. They are a vegan vegetarian restaurant. And in truth, I only get their appetizers and their desserts. But you can order like every appetizer on that menu and it is orgasmic.
That is strong terms. Nobody has used that word in describing a restaurant on this show to date.
I am passionate about food, my friend.
Have you eaten at Soul Veg?
I have. Actually, Soul Veg was the first vegan place I was introduced to in Atlanta. And I really appreciate the intentionality with which they cook at Soul Veg. And I think the only reason I wouldn't choose them as my favorite is because I can make a lot of the foods that they have.
So there's one in my neighborhood. I don't know if that's the one you go to or not. In the West End?
Yeah.
And when anybody visits me from out of town, it's usually the first place I take them because I know they don't have it where they live. Like, yeah. You've not had this fucking mac and cheese.
Oh, my God, dude. They're mac and cheese.
Right?
I will tell you, I have a friend, really good friend, and I have their recipe for mac and cheese. So
that's pretty hardcore.
Yeah.
But anyway, but it's a great place for me to take people because, like I said, we can walk to it, and I know they don't have it in their neighborhood at home. So that's awesome. How long have you lived here in Atlanta?
I have been in Atlanta since 2005. Okay. So 12 years.
Okay. So it's good enough. For a minute, I thought maybe you weren't here that long. So what is the best concert you have seen in Atlanta?
Oh my God. That's so hard too. You picked like the two topics that... I mean, and we've already talked about meditation, but you pick the two things that are my life, music and food.
Right. You can name a couple.
Okay. So Crystal Castles at the Tabernacle a couple years ago. So Crystal Castles is now broken up. Alice Glass is not the lead singer anymore. But we waited for like an hour after the opening act for Crystal Castles to actually show up. And when they played their first note, people got so stoked that not a mosh pit, but just this sway of energy started. And I got lifted off of my feet and was being swayed back and forth through the crowd. All of that feeling of like all of a sudden there's no air because the air is hot and everyone is breathing at the same time happened in like 3 seconds flat. It was this really powerful, tangible shift in energy as soon as the first note dropped. And I will never forget that moment, ever. Ever. But I think Terminal West is my favorite venue in Atlanta. And I've seen a number of shows there. That's hard. Terminal West and Variety Playhouse. I love both of those. Variety Playhouse is beautiful for intimate shows. I saw Daughter there. And are you familiar with Daughter? She's kind of indie. Just really powerful female singer with really powerful lyrics. And I am not kidding you. As soon as she started singing any song, it was silent in the crowd, which is different than anything I've ever experienced at any other show. People talk through the songs.
Right.
Doesn't matter if they're emotional songs.
Right.
People are talking and drinking.
They're drunk.
Yeah. Not for a Daughter. And I think it had everything to do with being at Variety Playhouse where you're not standing next to a bar. There is no bar in the show space. And I think that makes a difference.
I saw Suzanne Vega at the Variety Playhouse.
Ah, how was that?
Speaking of, well, it's just because you mentioned You mentioned powerful women singers. It's funny. It's the only concert in my mind that I can think of that I went to by myself. Like my friends, it's like, you want to go to whatever? And people are like, yeah. Or if you knew they didn't really like them, you'd be like, hey, I'll buy you a ticket. You want to come to the show with me or whatever? And I just, nobody else I knew was into her in 1993. When did 99 Fahrenheit Degrees, whatever that album was, I don't know if you're a huge fan of hers, Blood Makes Noise, that was like a big indie hit back then. Yeah. Anyway, don't know what year that was. I saw her there by myself and really enjoyed it.
That's awesome. That's really awesome. I'm a big fan of people taking themselves on dates. I think we need to do that more.
Yeah. Well, I got over that as a traveler. As a traveler, you eat out all the time. Like, dude, I'm going to treat myself. This is awesome. Right?
Yeah.
Okay. Rank these in order. You ready?
Okay.
Falcons, Braves, United.
United, Falcons, Braves.
Interesting. Have you gone to the...
No. I need to go.
But you're a big soccer fan.
I am. I played soccer all through college, and my son played for a couple seasons, and I used to watch all the women's national games with my dad.
Oh, like the big Olympic team in like 92 and stuff?
Oh, yeah. My nickname on my soccer team was Wombach from from the...
Really?
Yeah. So I've always loved soccer. And when it comes to football, I don't turn it on. I don't have a TV at my house, so I don't turn it on by myself.
Are you just going to be every dirty hippie stereotype?
Probably.
We don't have a TV.
I wear deodorant and I wash my hair.
We don't have a TV. I'm a vegan. I teach yoga and meditation.
I know.
You're a walking stereotype, dude. Dude,
it's
lady.
Great, isn't it?
I mean, I appreciate you.
Thanks. Thanks.
You've got that whole, like, you're little, you've got that whole, like, pixie thing
going
on.
But I'm wearing a button-up shirt. Isn't that contradictory?
What do they usually wear? Tank tops?
I don't know, like, rainbow hoodies?
Is that it? Really?
I made that up.
I don't mention them in hoodies. I mention them in tank tops.
I wear those, too.
Right. But you do shave.
Do I shave? Yes, shave.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wasn't that what you said, or you shower. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Do you wear patchouli?
I don't wear patchouli, but I do wear tea tree.
Is that similar? Is that the 2017 patchouli?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much hand in hand with patchouli. Tea tree is awesome. It's antifungal and antibacterial. And so
what if I told you I have a soap that's made with caffeine?
Really?
Oh, yeah.
That would be amazing.
I know.
I mean, it absorbs through the skin, I'm sure.
Right. I just got some from a sponsor for my other thing.
I want to hear about how this goes for you.
We can talk offline.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, I definitely want to know.
And there we have it, my chat with Tiffany. It was quite enjoyable. I'm glad you spent the time to take it in and listen. Hey, are you listening to Atlanta Monster yet? Put out by the beautiful people over at How Stuff Works, another amazing local podcast empire going on over there. Go listen to Atlanta Monster about the Wayne Williams trial and everything that happened to him afterwards and all that fun stuff on your podcast app if you're not already listening. Like to support Atlanta peeps. Also, check out Vesta, our sponsor, our current sponsor for the program. Go get in shape, go get your butt kicked over at Vesta. All right, guys. Love you, miss you, mean it. I've got to run.